Sick of procurement bottlenecks? Get the cure with Bill Procurement. Bill is the all-in-one platform trusted by nearly 500,000 businesses to simplify their financial operations. And now they've introduced Bill Procurement, which pairs seamlessly with accounts payable to automate procure-to-pay workflows in one place. Every step, from submitting a purchase request to reconciling payment, happens in Bill Procurement, so your business keeps moving and growing. Score $200 when you see Bill Procurement in action with a demo. Go to bill.com/procurement200. bill.com/procurement200.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
The state is calling it political targeting. They're seeking the death penalty. But behind the headlines is a legal machine, one that is complex, high stakes, and slow by design. Tyler James Robinson stands accused of murdering Charlie Kirk in a calculated public attack. A note, a text, a long gun from a rooftop. But what comes next? How does a defense team fight a case like this? What happens when the death penalty is on the table? And what does the public need to understand about how the system actually works? It's a lot that's going to be happening in the coming weeks, months, years in this case. And it's important to understand what's going on before one decides to, jump on their social media and start spouting off about these horrible defense attorneys. How could someone defend him? It's their job and they don't have a choice. We're going to talk about that. Joining me, Eric Faddis, a criminal defense attorney and former prosecutor, to break down what's ahead and suppression from suppression battles to jury strategy to mitigation, appeals, and what justice is never, why it's never as simple as guilt or innocence. Eric, thanks for joining us. Let's just start with the fact it's a capital case. From your experience, how does a capital case immediately shift the way the defense has to approach the strategy, motion practice, and funding? Walk us through the legal terrain that gets activated the moment the state says, we're going to try and kill you.
Sure, Tony. Well, obviously, it becomes truly a life or death matter for the defense side. And a life was taken on the other side too. So extremely high stakes here. Usually most states, especially if there is public funding for the representation, have set aside additional reserves for funding for cases like this, for experts, for mitigation, for investigation, really everything under the sun, because that's what the defense team has to explore. This is their client's life on the line. And so no holds barred, and they pull out all the stops, and I anticipate they're going to do that here.
I mean, it's going to go with the very obvious question so we can get it out of the way, because everybody is going, well, he's on camera doing it.
Right.
He's admitted to doing it. He's got a note. His DNA's on the trigger. It's one of those, common sense would say, well, come on. I mean, but of course you have to try it. Either he has to admit guilt or it has to be tried in court. And then you have to have attorneys that represent him. Give us the explanation for the people that are out there going, who would represent him? Why do we even have to go through all this stuff?
Sure. And fair question. And there are a number of answers. One is that, in our society, we don't just sort of roll over and take whatever the government says as gospel, right? They have to prove their case. And that's only a meaningful requirement if there are challenges to the case, if that case is scrutinized by the defense side. Because we need to establish the authenticity of these alleged text messages between Tyler Robinson and his partner. We need to establish the identity of him on this surveillance video that is pretty grainy and not horribly conclusive. On top of that, if there's been a confession, we need to determine, hey, was that a false confession? Was he pressured in some way? All of these avenues need to be explored, especially when his life is now on the line.
How are they going to do all of that? And do you anticipate them challenging any of these things? Because I agree, and we already got a comment, did you see the fake text messages? People are throwing their conjecture in there, and it's their opinion. Great. Do I think it's a lot of it's weird? Yes, I do. I think there's a lot of weirdness to this whole damn thing. So let me just say that out there right now. But that's why we have court cases. That's why this is going through a trial, or maybe it will be. So to break all this stuff down, let's take, for example, the text messages. Do you think they're going to challenge this? And then if they do, what's the process? We've seen these sort of things challenged in other cases that are not of this high of profile, but where could all of that go?
Sure. So in looking at the text messages, like I said, the government has to establish that they are authentic, that they're not created by some AI, that they're not created by some investigator, that they need to establish the phone from which these or device from which these messages were sent. And they need to establish who the sender is. So, you know, when you look at the text, you say, oh, that seems pretty problematic for the defense. But there are, when you really break it down, a lot of requirements the prosecution has to meet. On top of that, I think defense would be remiss if they did not hold the government to their burden to establish, hey, these texts are authentic. They're from Tyler Robinson. Here's how we know that. There'll be digital forensics analysis to try and establish IP addresses, locational information in terms of where the device was used, when it was used, and by whom. And that all is going to play out in the coming weeks and months.
Okay, so let's play the conspiracy road here. If they're fake, which is a huge, huge if, and I'm not saying they are by any means, but let's say, how would they prove if they're manufactured? They came from the government showing us, hey, here's what we found. I mean, I'm assuming they're not going to go forward with things that are obviously easy to find as being faked, if they're faked. So that in itself presents an insane challenge of proving something is fake if it's already coming from them saying this is real. I mean, yes, I know you can forensically look at it, but this is a little different than, you know, Joe Blow and a domestic dispute or something. There's going to be a lot of, and people will challenge this, and of course the conspiracy theorists will go nuts with it. How do you suffice that to, let's say they are legit, how do you prove to anyone that they are, and truly make someone believe that they are, if they are? I mean, it seems like it's going to be a mounting battle both ways.
Oh, sure. Like you said, there's going to be a digital forensic analysis that looks at IP addresses, locational information, that kind of thing. But on top of that, what defense is probably going to do, they're going to take these text messages and they're going to look at other writings, other messages, other texts, emails from this defendant. And they're going to compare them and they're going to say, hey, is the tone the same? Is the verbiage the same? Is the sentence structure the same? Is the syntax and grammar the same? And if there is some stark contrast between Tyler Robinson's other messages and these messages, that at least raises a specter that, hey, where did these come from? Were these really from Tyler Robinson, or were they from some other source? So there's a lot of comparative analysis that is going to be done. And they're also going to look at, hey, you know, if the digital analytics say that this message was sent on this date from this location, but Tyler Robinson was somewhere else, well, we got a problem then. And so all of these considerations come into play.
It really has changed the landscape, hasn't it? As far as defending somebody. Now we have to look at AI. We have to look at, I mean, Sora, Tony did some amazing things over the weekend with Sora, which, if you don't know what that is, it's basically AI making videos, and they're so realistic. So how do you take a look at things and go, wow, the entire nation thinks it's one thing because of a video that was released and went viral, not saying it happened, but it could, versus what reality is? It's shocking.
It's a critical point, Stacey, and I think that the emergence of AI is going to have a drastic impact in the legal sphere, in the political sphere, and in other contexts. Yes. I mean, look, over the weekend, I saw this video that purported to show Stephen Hawking in his wheelchair on a skate vert ramp doing tricks.
It's real. He did that shit.
You know, it was darn convincing for what it was. And so, we've got to look at whether things have been not only fabricated, but whether they've been augmented, whether they've been changed in some way to sort of tip the scales of justice one way or the other. And it's not only the government we got to look at. We got to look at defense potentially doing that as well.
Well, and that's a scary thing, because people are going to believe what they want to believe. And if they see something that reaffirms their already held beliefs of whatever it may be, whether you think he did it or he didn't do it, or it's a conspiracy. And people will see things, and we don't know how this is going to work out yet. We don't know. And then what I was saying, how it's going to work out yet, is how AI at this level is going to work out in our society yet. There was recently a movie on, I think it was on what was it, Apple? Or it was Steve Carell was in it. It's about a bunch of tech bros. And the AI, they created this thing. Basically, it's Sora, where you can create almost any situation and it looks like a real news report and people are believing things that are not actually happening around them, things that challenge their political beliefs, things that get them upset, make them believe someone is going after something they feel passionate about, and the world erupts into chaos. We're pretty much there. We are right there right now, where this could become reality, where people are going to start doing that. And the same with this. People have a hard time digesting, accepting, and believing actual videos, things you can prove.
Yes.
And trace the, here's the security camera. Here's where this was shot. Here's showing him here. Here's all this. Here's all these people who saw it. Here's where he's on this. Like you could give a lineup of every which way that you could physically truly prove things are real, and you will still have people saying that's fake news. So what the hell are we facing when even the real stuff isn't believed? And they haven't believed it forever without this new noise coming in from the other side.
Yeah. So I think from a legal perspective, this is where the burden of proof comes in. You don't, as the government, have to prove something 100% that it's absolutely true. You have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And so what I would do in jury selection as a prosecutor sometimes, I would say, hey, if I told you my name was Eric Vadas and I showed you my driver's license,
fake news.
I had my mother come in here and say that I birthed this person, you know. Is it theoretically possible that I'm some body double, that I'm some faker who's assuming this guy's personality? I guess it's possible, but is it reasonable? And so that's where the government has to prove, hey, so long as we've proven it beyond a reasonable doubt, not all doubt, but beyond a reasonable doubt, the jury should accept it. So I think the burden does have an impact on that issue.
When you saw that Stephen Hawking video this weekend, and you started just kind of run it through your filters of like, okay, well, yeah, that's Stephen Hawking on a, you know, doing stuff on a skateboard park, obviously AI, but yeah, I saw him too. I even made a few versions of it. You do have to wonder, okay, how is this going to affect like jury selection, things like that in the future? People, I mean, obviously it's already hard to find jurors that are qualified in a specific jurisdiction on any sort of high profile case based just on the social media noise and all the stuff that people consume online. We had memes, we have, you know, people's opinions, blah, 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 blah. Keeping the topic on AI, how do you think this is going to be detrimental to going forward and finding qualified jurors, or is this just another piece of noise that society is going to find a way to filter out in some sort of way to tell real from fake? At least some people will. I don't know. I'm just curious to get your thoughts on that.
Oh, sure. I mean, we're as a society, we're going to have to adapt. And there's going to be some speed bumps along the way. And, you know, look, if I'm the prosecution in a case where that's a potential issue, I'm not wanting the conspiracy folks. I'm not wanting the people who sort of think outside the box.
No,
I want the more, mainline, standard type of thinker who can accept my position. If I'm defense, you bet I want folks who are going to question things, who are going to look deeper, who are going to think more critically into those matters, because they might find some doubt that the former group may not find.
Yeah. And there's like you were talking earlier, one of the things that a lot of people are questioning is not, I mean, the texts, then yes, the note, but I'd say the texts are really what people are wondering about. And look, I get it. It looks weird. The verbiage is not what one would think of a typical, 20-year-old today using. I mean, it just doesn't sound at all. I mean, if you were to just look at it on the surface and go, okay, is this a writing? What would you guess is the writer of this? You wouldn't think a 20-year-old. But, he was well-educated. He had good grades. He may just speak, not in dumb assinese, and the way most people do speak. Sometimes more educated ways of thinking, that doesn't sound right to me. That may just be what it is. You know, that could easily be. But if we do compare it to other writings, which we do not have, but
which we need,
it's going to be challenged or challenging, I think, for anyone to digest that and believe it, even if they have other writings of him. And it's going to be even more crazy if there are other writings that come to light from, which I'm sure probably will, from school, from friends, from whatever. We're going to see other examples. And if it doesn't match up and it doesn't sound like him, there's going to be problems.
Oh, 100%. And that's really a problem. Largely, the government is going to have to deal with.
Yeah.
Look, they're the ones bringing the charges. They're saying this is our evidence. Okay, we'll show it's authentic. Show that it's real. Prove that the defendant sent that. You know, even in the Young Thug case recently, there were some jail calls that were leaked, and at some point, Young Thug was saying, "Hey, those might have been AI. That doesn't sound like my voice. That doesn't sound like something I would say." So even when we have the vocal tone, the inflection from the alleged declarant, it's still not a firm, conclusive final position that we can reach. And so when we have a writing, it could be even more convoluted.
The AI stuff, obviously, it's all very, very new. I'm curious if you or any of your colleagues or anyone you know, and you just mentioned the Young Thug thing, but have you seen any other examples of that being challenged in court saying that must be AI when the evidence just simply, you know, is not favorable to the defendant?
What I've seen, and this, you know, this is an emerging technology,
yeah,
so there are limited examples. But one thing I have seen was that In Colorado, where I practice, there was a case where someone, a romantic partner, framed their other romantic partner by fabricating, I think they were texts, I don't remember exactly, but using some sort of AI generator. And defense was able to establish, hey, my client didn't send these, he couldn't have sent these. And so that alleged piece of evidence was debunked. So I've seen it go that way. Certainly, it could go the other way as well. I just haven't personally seen such an example.
What do you do about this, though? I mean, the other part of this case is he confessed to his family, allegedly. There was the family friend who, a priest or something as well, that helped bring him in. So you get a lot of moving parts over here. It wasn't a standoff where he's by himself, where he just walks in and turns himself in. You have a lot of other individuals that would be close to him in a family capacity, in a family unit, that have all been, you know, accused of being part of this, not in terms of shooting him, Charlie Kirk, but in terms of being part of bringing this man to authorities. So there's that, you know, in, you know, clearer days, would be pretty damn clear cuts. Like, your family turns you in. That to me seems pretty strong. Or is it not? I guess it would depend if they were to back out of some of this. We still have yet to hear any sort of statement out of the family in any way, shape, or form, as far as I'm aware, in any of this.
So important points on these alleged confessions. One, the alleged statements from Tyler Robinson to the clergy, those might be suppressed. Typically, there's a privilege in most states whereby you can disclose something to a priest and they might take action on it, but they can't be called as a witness against you. I think that privilege could apply in this case. And then on top of that, when we talk about the alleged confession to the family, what did he actually say? What were his specific words? And, you know, you have on paper, he confessed to his family. That seems really strong. But then you get those family members on the stand and mom says one thing. Dad says another thing. You know, a sibling might say, hey, it was actually more equivocal. It was more vague. And on top of that, you have a potential motivation by a young person to want to gain attention to perhaps piss off his family. I mean, who knows?
Right.
There are all sorts of possible motivations. And so you have what seems like a pretty sacrosanct confession, but then that thing can kind of unravel as we get into the gauntlet of trial.
Is there any chance that he didn't do this?
In my personal opinion, I think there's still a chance that he didn't do this. You know, Candace Owen, who is a prominent political figure, I guess you could call her, she has been rather steadfast in asserting that she doesn't think Tyler Robinson did this. There are some curious developments after this. You know, a lot of people are saying that Erica Kirk, Charlie Kirk's widow, her presentation was different than what they would have expected from someone who was killed. I'm not making any comment on that personally, but I'm saying questions have been raised about whether this is actually Tyler Robinson or if there is something larger and more nefarious going on. I don't take a position one way or the other, but mm-hmm. there are questions that at least should be asked.
Sure.
Is a lot of it just the public can't believe their eyes? They can't believe how simple this might have actually been. That you had someone who, through years of being not content, not happy, feeling put off, feeling offended, whatever, you know, he obviously didn't like Charlie Kirk. So insert whatever feelings he's having right there, that had access to a weapon, had access to a key card to a building, which I want to learn about that. How did he have mm-hmm. access to this building? You know, and that may be completely legit. You know, I don't know. You know, and he used the powers he had. It was a very lax security. I mean, they're like, why didn't security? Because there wasn't any security. They didn't think ahead enough to try and prevent something like this. They didn't. They just did not. It was shitty security all around. And it wasn't the role of the campus to provide more than they already had. They only had so many officers they could provide. He had his own private security. He's not the president. So you don't have Secret Service protection around Charlie Kirk. So it was a crime of opportunity. And in theory, the opening was there that somebody did. He did exactly what he said. He saw the opportunity and he acted on it. And then people are reacting to that because it's too simple. I think in some mind, we think of things like this and we think, oh, people plan this forever. We think of like Oklahoma City. We think of the Unabomber. Mm-hmm. We think of 9/11. We think, oh, they're doing this and they're doing that because it must be much more nefarious. Not just some kid that has little problem solving skills and is offended and has access to high power weaponry and a key card. That could be as simple as it is. And then the Erica Kirk too. Could it just be as simple as it is? This is how she reacts. This is how she reacts to trauma and tragedy. It's not how I would react. It's not how you would react. It's not how your sister would react. It's not how your cat's cousin would react. It's how she reacts. Like it or not, it's how she reacts. But everyone wants to judge what's appropriate or not, or what they think is appropriate, not by their standards. And then if it's not according to theirs, then it must be something's up and something's wrong. People not really accepting reality on reality's terms? Or is it, you know, are we pointing out this just doesn't feel like reality? Because it doesn't.
It's a very important point. You know, looking at Erica Kirk's response, she was thrust into the public limelight in the most tragic of ways, having just lost her husband. And then, you know, who knows how a person would react to those circumstances. She is now at the helm of this Turning Point organization, which is a very large national entity. And she's trying her best potentially to make sense of it all and to navigate the next steps. And that could very well be what's going on. I think a lot of folks are a little guarded when it comes to, like you said, the emergence of AI, this sort of, you know, alternative facts and, you know, fake news and stuff like that. I think these things that have arisen in our society have caused folks to be more guarded about not just readily accepting something that is put on a plate and a nice little package in front of them. And so perhaps that is what's fueling some of the skepticism regarding the case, and it could be as simple as the government is portraying it.
I think that's the scary part to a lot of us. Is like, wow, it could just be that simple that these sort of things can happen. People, it shatters comfort levels. It shatters, you know, barriers that we have of what we believe of our own security when we find out, oh my God, it was that easy for this to happen. And that's a scary thing. I want to talk about the charges on this, the charging document, political targeting enhancements. That's not commonly used, but it is sometimes. How does political targeting enhancement, how does that work legally, and what kind of evidentiary burden does the state have to meet to justify that, and how does it help their case?
Yeah, so I think the state's going to use it as an aggravating factor in the death penalty phase. How it works in a death penalty case is there's first a guilt phase. So really, there's two trials. The first trial is the defendant guilty? The second trial is is death an appropriate sentence? And in that second penalty phase, the prosecution presents aggravating factors. This will be one of them, that this was a politically motivated assassination. And that makes it more serious in the eyes of some. And so the government will have a burden of establishing at the penalty phase, if they get that far, that the aggravating factors beyond a reasonable doubt outweigh some of the mitigating factors. And there are mitigating factors that the defense is going to put forth.
Do you think this is ever going to actually reach a trial, like in a courtroom, or is this going to be as many cases? Because the evidence that does exist, if we are to believe it, if we're to accept the government's case and say, okay, you got the DNA, you got this, you got that. I mean, it's a pretty clear cut, like you're not going to win fighting this unless you try to nullify a jury, which I don't think that's going to work at all in this case. If this is the way it is, do you think we're just going to end up with a plea deal to take death off the table? Let me ask you that first before I go to a follow up.
You know, Tony, I think it's a plea deal is less likely in this case than it may have been if this case happened 10 years ago. One reason, for better or for worse, I think there is some political aspect to everything going on. You know, the Utah governor, who's Republican, has said that he wants the death penalty. President Trump, who's Republican, has said he wants the death penalty. Charlie Kirk was clearly Republican, the victim and mm-hmm. alleged victim in the case. And so, you know, there's more pressure on that side to drive this all the way home if they can. And in order to do that, they would have to not extend a plea offer. And so I think a plea offer is less likely in this mm-hmm. case, but prosecution has some exposure. There's no guarantee they win at the death penalty phase.
And it would also then that in the interest of it's not to stifle people that have conspiracy theories, but in the interest of bringing truth to light, if there's truth to be brought to that light, a trial would be the most advantageous way to do it, because all of these things would then have to be parsed out. Everything we just talked about. If there's a plea deal, all this stuff goes under the table. It's done. There's really nothing. We're not going to know. It's just going to be like, well, it's what they said. So I guess that's what it is. That's why he's going to jail for prison for the rest of his life. If there is a plea deal, if we do end up in court, all these things will go under a microscope. All these things will be examined by people more than just the federal government. If in fact they are going to try and fight and say he's innocent, but we don't know where that's going to go yet, obviously.
Yeah, right. And I think, you know, that's the central purpose of a jury trial, is to find truth. Now, does it always find it? Absolutely not. But in theory, that's the objective. And what happens, like you said, is that evidence would be scrutinized. It would be challenged. There would be alternative, plausible explanations presented by defense, and the jury would have to weigh, hey, is this what the prosecution says it is? Or is there reasonable doubt as to this alternative explanation for whatever is being presented? That's when it comes down to it in that jury trial. It'd
be very fascinating to see how that works. Let me ask you this. The attorney that has been appointed thus far to this, obviously they have to be death penalty qualified. And they've been appointed, again, I want to make that clear. It wasn't like somebody said, hey, pick me. It's what the hell do you think's going through that poor person's mind right now as they're realizing, oh, my God, now I mean, because like nobody's going to, plenty of people will understand this is the person doing their job. This is but the other 80-90% of Neanderthals will be like, screw them. It's like, okay. I don't envy that person at all. What do you think they're dealing with?
They certainly have an uphill battle ahead of them. But you know, in thinking about other cases, you look at the Aurora Theater shooting case, James Holmes in my home state of Colorado. And, you know, that guy killed more than 10 people. And it was the evidence was pretty compelling that it was him who did it. And the government still did not convince a jury to sentence him to death. In fact, it was mm-hmm. George Brockler who was at the helm of that trial for the government. I just beat him in a homicide trial. he didn't do a great job in that case. But with the Worth shooting case, even though it seems very clear cut, that doesn't mean that there is a foregone legal conclusion of death. The defense still has some legal traction, not only to challenge the guilt of their client, but also to try to spare their client's life at that penalty phase. So even though it appears very overwhelming, there is still a lot of work that can be done on the defense side.
Lots of questions, lots of possibilities for where this Choose Your Own Adventure book may end up going. And it's scary to think about. Eric Faddis, thank you for your insight on this. Let us know your thoughts in the comments section, wherever you are listening to us. Be sure to press subscribe and let us know your thoughts on YouTube. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.